How many hours in any single day can I pray to a league table, but it still don't change? That's Los Campesinos. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The MLB league table barely changed yesterday, at least for the Blue Jays. They did lose half a game in the wild card with the games that were in action, but the Jays were not. They remained 45 and 54. They remained 15 games back in the division. They remain 10 games back of the wild card. Their run differential is bottom five in the league. They are bottom seven in the league in run scoring, runs allowed. Yeah, we're playing out the string until the trade deadline, which is 1 week from today. There are games to play. We'll set up this series between the Jays and the Rays throughout the show. That one gets going down at Rogers Center tonight. Jose Berríos against Sean Armstrong, who will be the opener for the Rays as they do a bullpen day, as the Rays are wont to do. So we'll set that one up. We have Neil Solons coming on. He's the Rays radio voice. He'll join us around 10:35. Ben Clemens of Fangraphs is going to join us at 11. We'll go a little longer with him. He has dropped the first couple parts of his annual trade value series at Fangraphs. We've brought him on to talk about it the last couple years as well. Always fascinating given the amount of reporting he does that goes into that. And not a big Jays presence. So we'll talk about the Jays guys who are no longer on the list. And we'll talk some deadline stuff with him as well. But the list is not exactly flush with Toronto Blue Jays, as you might expect for a team that is 45 and 54. Let's check in on that team. Let's set the table for the week ahead. Let's talk to our pal Kayla McGrath of the... Oh, she is not there yet. Okay, you guys got to tell me that stuff. Okay, so Jays, yeah, Jays, Rays, Jose Berríos against Sean Armstrong tonight. It'll be Yariel Rodriguez against Zach Eflin tomorrow. It'll be Chris Bassett against Taj Bradley, who has turned in a really nice season so far on Thursday. That's a tough one for me personally. Bought all the stock in Taj Bradley heading into last year as on the fantasy standpoint, did not reap the returns, and now I'm not enjoying that. I'm not on the good side of that. We're also going to give away some tickets a little later. The Jays play the Rangers this weekend. It's Caribbean Carnival down at Rogers Center for the weekend, particularly on Friday. So we'll give some tickets away to that. Okay, we do have Caitlin McGrath now of The Athletic. Again, guys, you got to let me know. Okay, Caitlin, how are we doing? What's going on? How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am. I'm pretty good. So how are you feeling right now? We are 1 week and 8 hours from the deadline. I'd imagine that is taking up most of your kind of brain space as it pertains to work. How are you feeling?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's been a while since the Blue Jays have been sellers. So that's kind of a different, a different approach to it. Just as a reporter, I think that, you know, I was talking to one of the other beat reporters, and, you know, there's differences. Like, sometimes it's almost more fun when the team is buying, because you can do a lot more like what player could fit. And, like, you know, you can kind of speculate and guess and try to predict or try to say, oh, this, like, you know, this pitcher would really fit in the back of their bullpen, or, you know, they need a left-hander, so maybe they should target these guys, and trying to figure out, you know, maybe teams that they've dealt with before. And but like when they're selling, I think it's really hard to sort of guess where they could go. I mean, obviously you can make some guesses, like, you know, teams that might be interested in rental starters. Maybe it's the Twins, maybe it's the Guardians. You can kind of, like, you know, guess and speculate a little bit. But sometimes being like covering a selling team, you're almost kind of more like waiting. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the difference.
Yeah. The last two years I had a spreadsheet of like, hey, here are like 35 different relievers that they could target that I've cobbled the list down to based on guys from, you know, bad teams who are pitching relatively well, who, you know, a team might actually be willing to trade. And this year you can't do that. You can look, there are 22 teams that Fangraphs gives 8% playoff odds or better to. So there are a lot of teams you could look at, but then you have to do the, well, they're looking at a spreadsheet of 35 relievers. And is Jimmy Garcia at the top of that one? Probably, but you know, you don't know for sure. So I feel you on that, Caitlin. Caitlin, do you remember the last time the Blue Jays sold and where you were versus where I was when they made the big sale?
I do remember. I think I was on a flight to Kansas City and you were in the craziest Blue Jays clubhouse in a while, I think.
Well, I wasn't in the clubhouse because we weren't allowed. That was the day Marcus Stroman got traded for Anthony Kay and Simeon Woods Richardson. And the story there is I was filling in for Caitlin at The Athletic while I was still there, and she was headed to, I think, Kansas City for the deadline series there. Stroman got traded. They would not let us in the clubhouse. There was a huge ruckus. And then he almost flattened me coming out of the locker room in a huff, trying to leave in a hurry. Luckily, I'm very stout, and you can't knock me over like that. Caitlin, so the Jays are at home until Monday, so we probably won't run into a situation like that. You've got a nice trade deadline-friendly schedule. Other than it being a doubleheader on Monday, it's just going to be a heavy work week. But what is this week like for you? Obviously, you still have to write. You're going to be down at the ballpark having conversations and things like that. But are you kind of feeling that, like, just wait and see when it comes to covering these next six games as well?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it feels a little bit more waiting as opposed to sort of being proactive and trying to predict. I think there's also just, like, less intrigue when the team is trading away in terms of, like, where they'll go. I don't think that people are necessarily like, oh, like, where will Kikuchi go? Like, as if that's what they're anticipating. I mean, obviously they're trying to anticipate what they get back. But I think it's more so people are wondering, like, what is the volume of packages? And I think it's really hard to, like, kind of predict what team will pay the most. Mm-hmm. So it is a little bit like kind of just waiting and seeing. I think it's, you know, talking to some of my colleagues at The Athletic, obviously, like, they are covering teams that might be interested in certain players on the Blue Jays. So it's kind of like listening to their insight, seeing if, you know, it actually would work for the, you know, for Kikuchi to go to the Twins, for example, or something like that. So that's kind of what it is. But yeah, I mean, it's a weird week too, because obviously the games are still happening, and, you know, the Blue Jays, you know, to their credit, a lot of the players are kind of just remaining focused on the season. You know, it doesn't seem like a lot of guys want to throw in the towel or kind of admit that, you know, the season is done. I mean, guys are still kind of talking about, you know, the chance the Blue Jays can, you know, make a run here. I mean, obviously they're professional athletes. I think they're just wired that way. And, you know, I think everyone probably realizes the reality is they're not going to be competing for a playoff spot this year, but guys just, you know, aren't wired to really admit that. My biggest thing that I'm wondering, I think we all know kind of the obvious guys who are probably going to be traded. You mentioned a couple of them, you know, Garcia, Kikuchi, you know, maybe Justin Turner, Kevin Kiermaier, even Danny Jansen is potential. But I think that the one that I'm really wondering is like Chris Bassett, because mm-hmm. he's the one that's kind of on the bubble for me, where it's like, you know, if they move Chris Bassett, I'm not like, oh, they're not competing in 25. Like, you know, if they move, you know, Vlad, then you're like, okay, this is a huge shift. This is a team that is, you know, closing the book on an era here and entering a new phase. Even if they were to, you know, trade some other guys where I'd think like, okay, even like a Gausman or something, I'd be like, this is pretty significant. But Bassett's kind of on the bubble for me, where it's like, you know, he's only signed for one more year. You don't know what you're going to get from him next year, although obviously he's proven that he's been as consistent as can be these last 2 years. He's probably someone that you can get a little bit more from just because he has that control and he's been really good. And just in the market where there's not going to be a lot of sellers and there's not going to be a lot of pitchers available, maybe you can get a lot for him. So that to me is the one that I'm really wondering, because I think that to me would signal like the Blue Jays are a little bit more serious about selling and trying to kind of get the most out of this deadline.
That one makes sense. And I had wanted to ask you about that, because I know you guys were all asked at The Athletic to make a bold prediction for every team at the deadline, and yours was that they do trade Chris Bassett. So yeah, you know, 1 year with $21 million left on his contract after this season, he's going to be 36 next year. Certainly not showing signs of slowing down right now. This would be his seventh consecutive season, two of those being partial seasons, but still with an ERA below four, and the ninth time in 10 career years, again, including small partial seasons where he had an ERA below four. The only time he hasn't was back in 2016 when he only pitched 28 innings. So pretty remarkable consistency there for Chris Bassett. And yeah, you'd have to think, Caitlin, that a lot of teams would be in the market, and it's probably, I wonder if it's, you know, if the Jays do reach that point, if it's a little easier because you're already having conversations with all the teams that need pitching around Yusei Kikuchi. And I'm sure they've asked on the Chris Bassett asking price as well. So, yeah, I mean, are there, you know, I know you just kind of laid out that it's a little tougher to do the, hey, where do you think a guy will land? But in talking to your colleagues at The Athletic, and I mean, you know, Ken Rosenthal and Jim Bowden on the reporting side, but also the other beat writers and stuff like that, are there, you know, teams that you look at a little more closely when it comes to a Bassett or a Kikuchi right now? It does feel like a lot of teams could use a starter.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of teams could use a starter, obviously. I mean, I guess if we, like, take out the American League East, because I think the Blue Jays would not be interested in moving Chris Bassett there, just because then you'd probably see him the next year. But, you know, I wonder, like, if a team like the Cardinals, he could be a fit there. I mentioned the Twins before. Cleveland probably wouldn't be interested in taking on that much salary, but, you know, you never know. Obviously, the Blue Jays have the long relationship with Cleveland there. You know, the Dodgers probably are probably a team that really stands out as well, as a team that pretty much desperately needs starting pitching. And, you know, obviously they have the money. They could take on the salary. Chris Bassett, you know, he's a guy that is really competitive. I think he would, you know, fit with the Dodgers. I think it doesn't seem like he wants a trade, but I think he might, you know, warm up to the idea of going to a team like that. Obviously big move and everything, but you know, I'm probably missing some teams, and maybe there's some that you've thought of, but I mean, again, like, starting pitching is probably going to be really sought after at the deadline. I mean, there's not many teams that couldn't use another starter, I think. And obviously just in this day and age, with the number of injuries and you know, the depth that teams kind of need with their starting rotation, you know, I think a lot of teams will want him. It's just a matter of, would they take on all the money? How would the Blue Jays, you know, negotiate that? Would they get more back or what? But yeah, I think that one to me is the most interesting piece of this deadline. And yeah, I did make the bold prediction that he would go. I don't know if that's bold enough, but you
that's
know,
pretty bold.
I honestly just think saying Vlad getting traded is just not in the cards at all. I don't think it's going to happen. So I think the Bassett one could go either way for me. You know, I could really see the Blue Jays doing it because I think it makes a lot of sense. But I could also see them holding on to him because, you know, he's an important guy for their clubhouse. Maybe it would be too devastating to lose him. Maybe they want him next year in their rotation leading the way. So there's a lot of factors to consider and what it means to trade him and what it means to not trade him. But I think if it was me, I think I would probably decide to do it just because I do think that, you know, you could get a lot. And if you're not going to trade Vladdy, and again, he'd probably be the best bat available and obviously controllable, you get a lot back for him. And you ultimately make the choice not to trade him. And I understand the reasons why you wouldn't. But again, trying to make the most of this deadline and the most of this year, I think means trading someone that can get you a little bit back more.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's one of the tough challenges, and something your colleagues, again, Rosenthal, Bowden, Keith Law, they've all expressed some skepticism that the plan of, hey, sell the expirings and then retool for 2025, that might not be enough. This is a team that, you know, the pieces in place are 10 games under 500 and 10 games out of a playoff spot. So, you know, the 50, 60, maybe even $70 million you have to spend next year, plus the regression for some guys, is doing an awful lot of work. And then, you know, again, I'm incredibly fond of Chris Bassett, the pitcher, and as a guy to talk to, but he's going to be 36 next year. Are you betting on a fourth consecutive year of your starting rotation being really, really healthy? I don't know. It's a tough bet. So you do have to consider these things. Chris Bassett, by the way, lined up right now to start on deadline day. Yusei Kikuchi lined up to start, I think, Friday's game. So yeah, some potential goodbyes this weekend. Do you think we see Kikuchi pitch Friday? We probably do, right? Like with how late everything grinds down to the actual deadline.
Yeah, I mean, things go so down to the wire these days. You know, especially probably in this market, because I think that, again, like, the Blue Jays are going to be, you know, one of only a handful of sellers probably, and probably one of the sellers that do have a significant amount of players to sell. So they're probably going to be talking to multiple teams, and I think it will probably just go down to the wire. And I mean, you know, knock on wood, I guess Kikuchi's been pretty durable for the entirety of his career. So I don't know that the Blue Jays would have any issue starting him as they normally would. He's, you know, not a guy that's really ever shown any signs of wear and tear or anything like that. So I think we would see him start. I guess we'll see. But the Bassett one's more interesting to me because that is on deadline day. I mean, I guess the deadline would be before that game, I think, right? Because that's a yes. Tuesday night game. So, yeah, I guess, you know, if he's not starting, like Bowden Francis is, I don't know, hiding in the wings or something.
And you've got the doubleheader on Monday. So you're going to have a 27th guy come up. Get ready to know, I don't know, who's this year's Wes Parsons? Andrew Bash down with the Bisons? Bo Salsa or something like that? Paolo Espino? It could be a weird Monday, Tuesday. Caitlin, do you have like a game plan for Monday? Like obviously Monday with a traditional doubleheader, I think 3 o'clock. And then the second one I'd imagine would take place around 6:30, 7 o'clock. And then the deadline is at 6 with a 6:30 game. Have you like worked through what your game plan is in Baltimore Monday, Tuesday? Are you just sitting at the arena all day?
Probably. I mean, I haven't really thought that far ahead. I'm like the players where I just take it day by day, okay. Game by game, just focus on today and then worry about tomorrow. So I'm just worried about getting there because the flights to Baltimore, there's no more like direct to Baltimore in the morning. So and that one, because of the doubleheader, you have to go the day before. And I have this really weird flight route. Like I'm flying to Atlanta and then I'm flying to Baltimore. I know it's so weird. And I actually was looking at it the other day and I'm like, did I make a mistake? Like, is this correct? But I think it's I'm flying WestJet/Delta and the Delta hub, I think is in Atlanta. So I guess that's why I'm going there. I have no clue.
Yeah, that's an interesting trek. I wish you the best. If you need to miss Sunday's Jays game, I can have your back again like I did in 2019. We don't work at the same place anymore, but I'm sure we can. You do the show enough. I'm sure Sportsnet won't mind if Chris Bassett runs me over and I pass along the quotes for you this year. So, Caitlin, look, we just talked about a couple rotation guys. That's going to look pretty different. The bullpen already looks way different than we kind of expected it to look this year because of performance and injuries and things like that. How different is this bullpen going to look by Tuesday night next week?
Yeah, I mean, maybe not too different. I guess we could have the same conversation about Chad Green that we just had with Chris Bassett, where he's a guy that, you know, trading him probably isn't throwing the towel in on next year. If you're trying to, again, maximize your return this year and make the most of this year, you know, maybe he's a guy that you consider trading. Obviously, relief pitching, much like starting pitching, is usually pretty in demand at the deadline because more often than not, every contender, with the exception of probably a few, always kind of need more relievers, or you can always have one more guy that, you know, can handle late innings, and you know, you want that for the postseason when you know, bullpens are probably, you know, as important as ever. So you know, he's probably another guy that you could consider trading. I think Garcia is probably, much like Kikuchi, is as good as gone, assuming that the Blue Jays can you know, have him make, you know, one or two more appearances where he just looks as good as he looked on Saturday. So teams are kind of, you know, rest assured that the injury layoff does not have any impacts on him. He's, you know, still continuing on with the best season of his career, really. So I think he's probably gone. I don't know to who. I think I was reading, you know, the Diamondbacks, I think, really need some relief help. They're obviously a team that the Blue Jays have a really good relationship. You know, Ross Atkins has a good relationship with their GM. They've obviously made deals before. So maybe that's somewhere that he could go. I mean, again, there's obviously a lot of teams, the Mets, I think, assuming that they buy, could use relief help. There's a lot of teams that he could land with. And yeah, I think Chad Green's maybe the other guy that you could consider moving, who would have some value and teams might be interested in because he has control next year.
Yeah, and I think John Morosi put out this morning the Yankees have interest in Chad Green, which makes a lot of sense. Former Yankee, they're not going to blush at the $10.5 million owed to him next year. So yeah, should be a lot of teams with interest there. Caitlin, do you have a sense of, so obviously we're talking through a lot of this with this idea that the Jays will, you know, they're going to sell now, but they're going to try to be good again in 2025. And there's a lot of work to be done with that to get this team back to where they're good next year. Do you think this front office would prioritize nearer term prospects or even like fringe major league guys, like when they picked up Teoscar Hernandez, for example, versus, you know, just getting the best possible prospect return? Like, do you think they'd have a preference for guys who are a little closer?
I mean, you would think that they would. I mean, I think they could maybe balance it and, you know, try to take a little bit of both. I mean, I think that it's been written about, like, their farm system is probably in the sort of bottom third. I don't know where it would rank after this draft. I'm not sure that people have sort of gone through the farm systems, like, deeply enough to know where they all rank now. But coming into this season, at least, I think they were ranked, you know, I know on Keith Law's list they were 20th. They might have been lower on some lists out there, but certainly just in the bottom third of the major leagues. And so, you know, they can improve their farm system probably at every level. I think, though, that, you know, what stands out is their lack of pitching depth at the upper minor league levels, and even their just lack of depth in general. Like, obviously, they've basically called up, like, most of the guys that can be called up this year, assuming that you're not going to want to call up, you know, someone else that maybe isn't quite ready, but you want to give them the opportunity. And obviously, Aurelvis Martinez being suspended kind of impacts that too. Presumably, he would be with the club if he could be right now. So, yeah, I would think that they would target somewhat of the upper minor league levels, just because, again, like you said, if they want to compete again next year, maybe they need to bolster their depth at that level and kind of worry about the lower minor leagues later, and kind of just continue to try to build that up through the draft and international signing. But if they want to kind of speed up that competitive process, or they want to kind of make sure that what happened this year, where their depth is kind of exposed, doesn't happen next year, then yeah, I think that targeting some, you know, fringe major leaguers or just those upper minor league levels would probably be a good idea for this team.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense the way you lay it out there, Caitlin. Okay, let's pivot off the trade deadline a little bit, but in that same idea of kind of, hey, there are a lot of guys from the minors up right now that they're already getting a look at. Bo Bichette is going to be out for a little bit here. I know you wrote about this for The Athletic when the news came down over the weekend, and John Schneider gave us an update. Hey, at least Bo Bichette doesn't have to worry about answering trade questions anymore for the at least until you know, he pops up somewhere in the offseason. Did you get the sense from John Schneider that, given that this is the third time it's come up and the MRI showed a moderate strain, that, you know, they're going to be like, we're not going to see Bo Bichette back after 10 days or 2 weeks off the IL here? They're going to be a little more like there's no reason to rush him back competitively, and he's got to get this right. Do you anticipate this being a bit longer term?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, usually the team is, like, very cagey when they give us injury information, and I think they like to sort of, if they can, like, avoid a pretty direct timeline. Like, a lot of times it's more vague, or it's like, we're hopeful that it'll be short, or we're not worried about it. And I felt this one, it was like right out the gate, once they had the information, it was like, he'll miss multiple weeks. And, like, to me, that seems pretty significant. Like, multiple weeks to me is certainly more than two or three. Like, I think we're talking at the very least a month, and then maybe even more. Like, maybe we're talking about 6 weeks. I mean, I think that there is probably some concern with the amount of injuries that have happened in that right leg area for him. Again, obviously the two calf strains this year, two and a half, I guess. The one that was probably in before the break is probably connected to this one. So two calf strains, you have the right knee injury that happened last year. Then you had the quad that happened right after it. Again, all in that right leg. So I think that once you have repeated, even if they're not directly connected injuries, I think that there is just some level of concern where you're having, you know, the same kind of injuries in the same areas. So I do think that there's going to be a lot of patience to get this right. You have to also consider, like, you know, he hasn't had the year that he wanted to have. You know, are these injuries somehow connected to that, right? Like, has he not been feeling right for most of the season? So I think that the focus probably is just get him right, get him healthy. There is really no need to rush him back. I think that probably, I don't want to say he was rushed back before, because, you know, I think the first calf strain was fairly mild. But at the same time, obviously it's reoccurred now. So I think it's in the best interest of him, you know, just to like take the time that it needs to heal. And, you know, if he doesn't come back this season, you know, it's unfortunate for him, because I'm sure that he wouldn't want to miss that much time. And I'm sure he would want to get back on the field and see if he can kind of look more like himself. But at the same time, you know, you're thinking about the rest of your career and the longevity of career, and you want to make sure that, you know, this injury doesn't have any lingering impact. So I think that getting him right, however long it takes, is going to be the priority.
So among these guys who we're going to get a longer look at here, Leo Jimenez, obviously we've seen Ernie Clement a lot more. IKF's another name we probably should have thrown out there as a possible 2025 guy who could get dealt if there's a market there for him. But, you know, you've got, you know, we've seen a lot from Horwitz. We've seen a lot of David Schneider at this point. But Leo Jimenez, Ernie Clement, Addison Barger's back up. Stuart Baroa is on the roster, although he doesn't really play. We're maybe going to see Bowden Francis backfill a starting rotation spot. There are relievers who will come up. Who are you most interested to see over the course of August, September in terms of, hey, what is the role? What is the impact for 2025? Like, which individual guy do you think can do the most to impact their 2025 standing?
Yeah, I mean, I think Spencer Horwitz is probably the guy that's already done a lot for it, and maybe he can just do even more. I mean, he's pretty much, you know, earned himself, you know, as much playing time as possible this year. I think that he really has impressed me. I think the move to second base has been really good for him. I haven't really seen him, you know, he just looks right at second base, I guess. He looks like he fits the role. He hasn't really struggled defensively at all, other than very, very minor things. And, you know, he'll only just continue to get better at that position. And obviously the bat kind of profiles better there. So he's a guy that I think can only, you know, continue to raise his stock for next year. I think Jimenez is also a guy that I've been pretty impressed with early on. I think that his skill set, you know, could fit really well with this team. And, you know, he's kind of fun to watch defensively. And obviously, you know, Bo will be back next season at the very least. So, you know, I don't know where Jimenez necessarily fits on the roster, but just the way he plays, his style, his confidence, his poise, like, I've really been kind of impressed with him so far. So he's another guy that I'm definitely excited to watch and see what he does with this kind of bigger opportunity to play shortstop, probably for a pretty extended run at this point.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. Okay, you also had a piece at The Athletic the other day. What's there to look forward to in the second half? And it's framed, that's a tough framing, but I have to ask, you know, the ankle injury continues to come back up, and he's not playing right now for the Buffalo Bisons. Is the Joey Votto return, if it ever happens, like, is that the number one thing on the kind of playing out the last 60, 70 games here?
Yeah, although I don't know. I don't know. It's like some of the gods, the baseball gods, are not smiling down on the Blue Jays this year. It's, you know, like, any nice positive thing they could have this year is just not happening. And so I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe a September call-up is still in play. Anything to salvage the season. Actually, I was talking to someone the other day, and I guess James Paxton was DFA'd by the Dodgers, right? So I don't know. Bring him home, even though he's from BC. Like, maybe
Damiano Palmegiani's down at AAA. Bring him up when Votto comes up.
Yeah, just get all the Canadians, as many Canadians as possible, gather them together and put them on the Blue Jays. That's with Vladdy. Maybe Jordan Romano comes back in September, and you just have them all. So maybe that's what will save the season, is just bringing as many Canadians to the roster as possible.
Well, it's not going to save the season, but I do remember a late season, hey, Russell Martin, you're the manager today, which was a nice kind of fun random wrinkle at the end of a season. I think we can aim for something like that at the very least, Caitlin. Caitlin, thank you so much for taking the time out. Good luck with everything this week and next.
Yep, thank you so much.
Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Make sure you're checking out all the work over there. Again, some good reporting from Ken Rosenthal, opinion stuff from Jim Bowden, and then Caitlin kind of taking that stuff and adding her own analysis to contextualize it. A lot of really good work up on that Blue Jays page at The Athletic of late. Levi Weaver as well doing some stuff. He'll join us tomorrow, as will Jim Bowden, and we'll talk some trade deadline stuff with them as well. Right now, though, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll take a check-in on the Rays. And how's this for, if you have some kind of number-oriented OCD stuff like your boy, the Rays are 50-50 after 100 games. nice and even and perfect, and they enter here at the 100-game mark. It's very satisfying. Not satisfying for the Tampa Bay Rays, though, who anticipated a sixth consecutive playoff appearance this year, and they are currently 5.5 back of that. Let's take a break. Let's get the state of the Rays with Neil Solans as JSTOC Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays off yesterday, back in action today, first of three against the Tampa Bay Rays at Rogers Center. Jays will then play the Texas Rangers over the weekend, then hit the road for Baltimore for a doubleheader and a deadline day game. Going to be a chaotic series there. A lot on the line these next two series against the Rays and the Rangers. Those are two teams that had playoff aspirations entering this year and are on the fringes of the wild card race, probably still deciding just how aggressive to be, buyers or sellers, or do you just ride it out and see? Let's get the state of the Tampa Bay Rays with their radio voice, Neil Solans. Neil, thank you for doing this, man. Good morning.
You got it. Thanks for having me on.
I got to ask first, how obviously being 50-50 is not satisfying given where the expectations were for the Rays, but the fact that the numbers are nice and round 50-50 at the 100 game mark exactly here, that's got to be nice to look at in the standings, right? Like just satisfy a part of your brain.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been an interesting year where it's almost been almost a 500 year throughout.
Yeah.
You know, the club, I think, has been 500 at 500, 23 different times, between 500 and three over the entire season. So it's almost like there's the ability there, but they haven't been able to kind of get that run. And the question is it going to come in these final 62?
It's a big question. I will say a little envious of even just being at 500 23 times. Sounds like it would be nice. Neil, I know that the Rays have dealt with a lot of pitching injuries. They never quite gotten fully out of gear like you just laid out there. This is a team, though, that is coming off six pretty good seasons in a row, had the expectations of being back in the postseason here. How different has that been for you to cover and call the games of every day, given how successful this team has been over the last half decade?
I mean, I think, you know, certainly I think from an organization standpoint, the goals, the aspirations were extremely high, and I think still remain extremely high for this group. And I think, you know, getting some of those starting pitchers back from injury real soon would be a welcome sign. You know, Jeffrey Springs is on the verge of rejoining the Rays. Drew Rasmussen just made his first rehab outing. Obviously, Shane McClanahan would be back next year. But I think that there's ability here still to get over the hump. I can remember a couple of years where the Rays have been actually at 50-50 or right around 500 at the 100 game mark and ended up with 90 wins. Now that's hard. That means you got to go at 40-22 in the final 62, and the schedule, you know, on paper would seem challenging, but you know, I don't think it's out of the question. It's whether, you know, guys all kind of hit their stride and get on the run.
And look, you just mentioned it. A couple of those pitchers are coming back soon to soon-ish. That's a big boost, although this team just has the terrible luck. Like Ryan Pepiot is on the IL now as well, which is why we'll see Sean Armstrong lead a bullpen day today. In addition to Springs and down the line a little bit, Rasmussen coming back, what would be the other thing telling you, hey, this team has better days ahead? I know they've played better ball of late, you know, taking, I think, what, 4 of 5, 4 of 7 against the Yankees, winning a series against Cleveland. A couple guys on the hitting side have started to play a little bit better. What are the underlying signs? Hey, this can be a better Rays team. They do have this push in them.
I would say they've lost one of their last 9 series. The one was being swept by Texas. And that really kind of, you almost took like 3 steps forward, but then a pretty big step back with all the series wins when you get swept. Pepiot's injury, he's probably going to be out for the minimum of 15 days. So he's going to be back real soon. I think, you know, as I look at what has allowed this team to take some steps forward, probably at the top of the list is the way Taj Bradley has pitched. And I know he's scheduled to go in the final game of this series. And he's really evolving into one of those guys that you're like, wow, he can really front a rotation going forward. And with Pepio's development and his growth, and I think Shane Boz will continue to improve, and then you get, you know, Springs back, it gives, you know, very similar look to what the Rays have had in recent years. And it always begins, I think, for any really good team with your starting pitching.
Yeah, it's a good point. You mentioned Taj Bradley there. Let's talk about him. Yeah, he's going to start this one Thursday. Man, has always been a guy that you watch, you look at the tools, you see some of the pitches that fly out of his hands. You're like, man, this guy is, he's going to be a legit weapon. Last year was obviously very trying and up and down for him, both in results and to the minors. What has been able to click for him? Is this just, I mean, 2.63 ERA, that seems to be more than just, hey, a young pitcher figured out how to pitch.
No, he's taken a lot of steps forward. I think last year part of the challenge was he was 22 and he was probably brought up to the big league level in part because of the injuries to Rasmus and Springs and McClanahan. Maybe a little bit earlier and a little more opportunity than he might have received. But I also think it gave him the chance to really learn. And his secondary pitches have taken a major step forward this year. You know, the fastball velocity is still in that 96, 97, 98 neighborhood for most of his outings. But I think the thing that really stood out is the development as weapons of both his splitter especially and his slider. Those pitches he's throwing with more velocity this year than he did, with more breaks than he did a year ago. He's getting more swing and miss on them, and they're also allowing his fastball to play better. And I think beyond that, I just think his mound presence and his poise have grown. His confidence has grown. You know, he really trusts his stuff now. And it's allowed him to take off. And, you know, it's been an amazing, I think, 8-start run where he's given up 5 earned runs. And, you know, who knows how that'll go in Toronto, because, you know, it's just hard to continue on that pace for a really long time. But I do feel that he's got the ability, the stuff, the total package to be a really good pitcher in this league for years to come.
It certainly looks like it. He's a guy, I mean, I've been high. Everyone's been high on Taj Bradley for a long time here. It's fun to see it actually produce the results now and see him figuring it out. Wednesday, we'll see Zach Eflin. It's been a little less of a success as last year. Not that he's been a bad pitcher by any means, 4.14 ERA, but the strikeout numbers are down. He's been hit pretty hard in a couple of his last starts. And I know, you know, hey, the Yankees are a tough team to play against. The Braves are a tough team to play against, et cetera. What have you made of Eflin's season and that, you know, that slight drop from front of the rotation guy to maybe an average type starting pitcher so far this year?
Well, you know, I think he's provided a lot to the organization the last 2 years in terms of what he's done and in terms of being a veteran that the young guys can lean on. You know, Taj, this is his first full year in the major leagues. Ryan Pepio's first full year in the major leagues. Shane Boz was out for 2 years coming back from Tommy John. And I think, and for Zach Littell, who had to be converted to a starting pitcher, his first full year in the major leagues as a starting pitcher. So, you know, I think Zach has been a really good guy for them to lean on, for them to help them grow as individuals. You know, I think maybe the numbers don't say how well Zach has pitched at times. I think there have been moments where he's had a little bit of tough luck. His last time out was really kind of wonky. It was almost like that first appearance out of the All-Star break, I think sometimes can go either way. And he had walked just 9 batters total in all of his previous starts and ended up walking 4 batters on that one given night. And that's really what got him in difficulty and in trouble on that day. And I would assume that, you know, knowing Zach and the way he works and the type of individual he is, he'll be right back in the strike zone. He'll be challenging hitters and, and he'll give his group the best chance they have to win.
Yeah, often we don't see Zach Eflin walk 4 guys in a month, let alone in a start. So it was a little odd to see that one. Okay, so it'll be Sean Armstrong today. Obviously, we don't need to go as deep on Sean Armstrong. It's an opener situation. I think it's the 6th time he's done the opener thing. I know the Rays used their bullpen a lot on Sunday. But we're able to get through yesterday with kind of just leaning on Tyler Zuber, fresh from the minors, and one other arm. Is it kind of an all hands on deck other than Zuber, typical Rays opener slash bullpen day?
You know, this would have been Ryan Pepiot's day to pitch. So, you know, my guess is that Tyler Alexander will probably be in a bulk role.
Okay.
And I know that, you know, that's my guess. Obviously that, you know, the Rays have the ability to change and adjust depending on how the game's going. But Alexander was on the taxi squad yesterday in New York. So I would think that he's going to play a significant role in the game today in some regard. And he did have his best outing of the year against Toronto.
Sure
the last
did.
Time he faced them in this building. So, you know, I think that, you know, we'll see how he fares. This will be his first outing back in the big leagues in a bit. But he's a veteran pitcher. He knows how to pitch. He, you know, pitches to contact, throws a lot of strikes. And, you know, I would assume it's just a matter of staying off the barrel, which, you know, I think both these teams have had challenges with this year. The Rays and Blue Jays have allowed, you know, 1-2 in terms of home runs allowed this year. It's, I think, probably a big part why they're either at 500 or, in Toronto's case, below right now.
Yeah, it's an odd one because these teams are both near the very bottom in home runs hit as well. So you look at a home run differential, these teams are kind of bottom of the league. It also makes, Neil, I don't know about you, I don't know what to expect. It's like the opposite of the irresistible force and the immovable object, because both these teams allow a ton of home runs but don't hit any home runs. I don't know which way that's going to shake out.
Yeah, it really is a matter of which hitters are able to take advantage of the balls that they do get in the middle part of the plate. You know, I've seen all of these starting pitchers for Toronto, especially Barrios and Bassett, be very, very good. You know, you're not going to get a ton in the middle of the plate, but when you do, you have to take advantage of it. And I'm sure Toronto is probably feeling the same way on the flip side of that. You know, in the Yankees series, the first 3 days, the Rays out-homered New York 9-1, and then yesterday the Yankees hit 5 home runs. So, you know, that's the beauty of the game, is you don't know what you're going to get on a given day. I don't know yet. Are we dome open or dome closed for the games in this series? Because sometimes that can play a factor too.
Yeah, we don't know for certain, but the forecast would certainly suggest we're headed for a dome open here. It's a pretty nice day, at least when I walked in it was. Yeah, the forecast is pretty good. It's going to be hot too, Neil, so get ready for that.
All right. Hot by Florida standards or Toronto standards?
Hot by Toronto standards. I don't know what the Fahrenheit is. We're talking like 27, 28 Celsius. So I don't know. What does that work at? High 70s, low 80s?
I'll take that.
Okay.
That's a welcome sight, being, you know, for the days we get in Florida.
On the position player side for this Rays team, I know they've been a little quiet about this, and maybe there's a reason for that. So if you can't answer, completely understand. Do we have a sense of when Yandy Diaz may return to this team? He's on the restricted list right now. For any Jays fan listening who isn't aware of that,
yeah.
He's been on the restricted list since the return from the All-Star break.
So, yeah, he was away from the club. All that's been said is a personal family matter.
Okay.
There was no further clarity on that yesterday. I don't know if, you know, if he'll be back today or not, kind of awaiting word on all that. And, you know, I guess probably when I would get to the ballpark, I would know more. I thought that kind of made it all the more impressive that this group ended up with, 10 home runs, 8 in the 4 games against the Yankees, and had 2 big run scoring games without him in the lineup. Because, you know, I certainly think, you know, as a guy who won the batting champ last year and I thought really it started to come on before the All-Star break, he really is kind of the engine for this lineup. So it was encouraging that they scored without him, and hopefully he'll be back sooner than later.
Yeah, he'd made a nice little turnaround there. Randy Rosarena had kind of turned it around after the tough start as well. What do you think's gone into the Rosarena turnaround? I know there's been some, you know, I listen to you guys on the radio sometimes, and there was a thought early in the year maybe he was trying to use too much of the field and a little over-focused on that. What have you made of him kind of figuring it out since the early part of May there?
You know, I give him credit for continuing to put the work in, because I can't imagine mentally how difficult it is when you're an accomplished major league player and you're 2 months into the season and you're hitting in the 150s and 160s and OPS in the fives. I think, you know, to his credit, he stayed after it. I think all through even the slumps that he went through, he was actually staying in the strike zone better than he ever had. And I think it was a matter of him getting his timing down. He was in what, you know, a lot of folks call that in-between mode, between fastball and breaking ball, where He was probably behind on the fastball and out in front on the breaking pitch, and he made the adjustments to get his timing down. And if you look at his last 6 weeks, he's been back at, you know, more what you would anticipate for Randy, and the strikeout rate went way down. I think it's like 21% in the last 6 weeks, where it was 28 or 29 in the previous 2 months prior to that. So he's getting pitches in the zone. He's getting himself, for the most part, in good counts. And when he does that, he's tough to deal with. Probably not very different from what, you know, I know George Springer's had a really good run lately. Probably pretty similar in terms of the fact that, that the adjustments may be different, but I think now they're getting their pitches to hit and they're taking advantage of them.
Well, Neil, this is exactly what my pregame hit is on a little later today, the similarities in those turnarounds. So thank you for confirming that for me. Last one before I let you go here. This is a Rays team that probably the thing they do best offensively is they steal a lot of bases. I think they're fifth in Major League Baseball. You know, even Josh Lowe, who hasn't hit very well lately, has been stealing a ton of bases. This is not something the Blue Jays control particularly well. We didn't see the Rays push it too much the last time these teams saw each other. Would you expect the Rays to push that a little bit more this series, given where their offense is at?
You know, I was looking at some of the numbers. I mean, Bassett's really good at holding the running game in check. I think he's allowed only six steals and 11 tries. And Berríos is reasonably difficult to run on, too. I think it depends on the situation. I think Kevin Cash always talks about the importance of running in the right spots and running in the right situations. And, you know, a lot of it depends on who's on base as much as, who the pitcher is, who the catcher is on the other side, how well they're changing their times to home plate. I mean, I think the Rays have done a much better job, especially the last 6 weeks, of running much, much smarter and picking their spots. I think the more they do that, the better they have a chance of putting pressure. To me, the stolen base is valued. The Rays have had at times a tough time holding runners aboard. I think they've gotten better at that recently, too. And I think that's part of the reason they, won these, seven out of the last nine series and lost just the one, is because they've handled the running game better and they've run a lot better. So how aggressive they will be probably will depend a lot on who's on base and more so probably how the starting pitcher or pitcher on the other side is handling the running game.
Which makes a lot of sense. It's not just enough to be fast. You got to be smart about it, too. Neil, thank you so much for taking the time out. Looking forward to seeing you down at the park later.
Sounds good. Thanks again for having me on.
Neil Solans, Rays voice on the radio side. Terrific broadcast that the Rays have, both on TV and radio, in my opinion, as do we here at Sportsnet, of course. We're going to talk to Ben Clemens at 11 o'clock. He's got his Fangraphs Trade Value Series out. We're going to go deep on that in just a minute. A couple of texts that we had in the text line left over from yesterday, I wanted to leave a minute to touch on. Shlomo and Scarborough asked, if we look at St. Louis as a seller last year and this year as a buyer, what should the Blue Jays do to follow the success of St. Louis's turnaround at the deadline and offseason? I don't know that I would hold St. Louis up as this terrific story of turning around seller season to a buyer season. One, because they are still only four games over 500. Like, it's not like they've turned it around to be like a legitimate contender here. Like, yes, they're probably going to make the playoffs the way things look. Even that, even probably might not be right. Like, they're probably going to win like 84, 85 games. I don't think I'd hold them up as the team that turned it around. I think the biggest thing the Cardinals have done, honestly, is like some of their older guys who look like maybe they were done have started to turn it around a little bit. So that's a pretty big part. And I don't know that you can just replicate that exactly. The Cardinals have also just always done a really good job finding and developing pitching, which always helps. And they pluck a couple Jays guys away. Jim and Barry asked, do you think George Springer's resurgence should give the team hope for next year? Not in isolation, like not as the only cause for hope, but I think that it's obviously a pretty big positive that he's been able to turn this around, that we can look ahead to next year and, not be like, hey, George Springer's a part-time player or a dead money, anything like that. You still have to factor in that aging is a process that will continue. Bat speed tends to go down with age, things like that. Very, very encouraging that George Springer can once again be a guy the rest of the way this season, and certainly has changed what the kind of aging curve looks like into 2025 for him. Max and Kitchener asks, who are the core players going forward? We will find out on July 30th. No, I mean, Vlad is the main one. The pitchers are all really nice to have, but they're also, you know, older and getting toward free agency. This is the question that they have to crystallize between now and the end of the 2025 offseason. Let's take a break. Let's tag in Ben Clements, talk trade value series over at Fangraphs as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Ben Clemens is going to join us in a couple of minutes here to talk trade stuff. He has his annual trade value column up at trade value series of columns up at Fangraphs. This is something Fangraphs has been doing for years and years and years. Kylie McDaniel, who's a regular guest of ours now, used to do it as well, and it's passed down from Fangraphs writer to Fangraphs writer. Who else did it? Kevin Goldstein did it. Craig Edwards did it. Dave Cameron did it. Kylie. So a lot of guys who then end up in major league front offices. If Ben Clemens wants that, I'm cool with it, but we'd lose a pretty good guess. That series has started to roll out at Fangraphs this week. Parts, the introduction and honorable mention are out. The 50 to 41 and 40 to 31 are out, and a subsequent 10 on the top 50 rollout each day this week. You don't need to wait for those for the Toronto Blue Jays inclusions, because no Toronto Blue Jays are ranked very highly. I went back and looked at the last several years of this trade value column and looked at the trends for Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who are obviously very highly regarded prospects and had success at the major league level right away, had 6 years of control, then, you know, in Bo's case was under a pretty reasonable deal through his ARB years, et cetera. And the trend is, I mean, the trend is about what you'd expect if you knew nothing else other than the amount of controllability a player still has, where, hey, when you have 6 years of a guy's value, be up here. And then in if you have 5 years of control, be a little lower, 4 years of control, et cetera. And now that Vlad and Bo have just 1.5 years of control left, their values are understandably lower. However, there are a lot of guys with a year and a half of control who are in their mid-20s who do appear on this list, and Vlad and Bo don't this year. So if you're Bo Bichette, you went from back in 2019, already you were on the radar as an honorable mention. And then you were ranked in 2020 as the 23rd most valuable trade piece in baseball. Now, that's not to say the 23rd best player, but when you factor in that he was making the league minimum and had 5 years of control left at that point, et cetera, he was ranked 23rd. That went as high as 20 in 2021, 21st in 2022, 20th in 2023. So a four-year stretch where Bo held his value, everyone in baseball, and again, these Ben and the others who have done this series, talked to front office executives, analytics people, scouts, et cetera, to get a gauge of everyone's value. And Bo for 4 years held there in the low 20s as one of the 20 to 25 most valuable trade chips in all of baseball if he were to be taken to the market. This year he's fallen off the list entirely and is an honorable mention only. So a pretty big drop off there that is not explained only by him being 1 year closer to free agency. Still a year and a half of Bo Bichette. Now obviously since this piece has been put together, Bo Bichette suffered another calf injury and is on the IL, so it's a moot point for this year, but it's still an interesting value exercise. Vlad, meanwhile, was on this list as far back as 2017 as like an 18-year-old. He was an honorable mention then. He went 18th to 10th to 24th to 2nd in 2021. He was number 2, 9th in 2022, and then 35th last year. He is just an honorable mention this year. Ben's comment on that kind of being to the effect of, well, it looks like he's a really good first baseman, not an MVP level guy. And given 1.5 years of control and the fact that Vlad is a super two, so he makes a lot of money, is not enough to get you in the top 50. There are no other Jays in the top 50. Alejandro Kirk was on that list last year. He has fallen off the bat, obviously just not doing enough this year to keep him on the fringes there, even though he does have 3 more years of control. So it's a pretty not great read if you're a Blue Jays fan. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us a lot, I think, about the window that the Blue Jays were operating within here, which is, you know, there are a couple of different ways to look at the trade value column. Obviously, if you're Baltimore, the selling point of your org is you have tons of guys on this because you have lots of good young players with years and years of control. That's one place you can be on the winning and development curve. If you're the Yankees or the Dodgers, you probably don't care about not having a ton of guys on here because you're fine. You're paying full freight on a lot of guys. You're paying the free agent contracts, and the guys with the big, big money free agent contracts don't appear as frequently or as high on this is because, you know, 6 years of Gunnar Henderson at making no money, well below market value, is just more valuable than, you know, a guy who's already making $50 million a year or is going to make $50 million a year very soon or something like that. So if you're the Blue Jays, you know, this was to be expected a little bit because this is the competitive window. You knew that by 2024, Bo and Vlad would be a little bit more expensive, a little closer to free agency. You supplemented that with free agent guys from outside the organization, especially on the pitching side. And those guys tend not to, you know, hold the trade. Like, the trade value is not the goal that you are searching for when you're building a team. But it is, you know, it is notable that the Jays have nobody on this list anyway. Text in the text line from a little earlier as we wait for Ben Clemens here. Jake in Bracebridge asked what the return would be for Chad Green from the Yankees. I don't know. that wasn't part of John Morosi's report. I guess I could just pick like a random minor leaguer. But, you know, I think to level set, and I don't know if anyone, if everyone speaks in this language, but, you know, when we talk about prospects, because we're comparing across orgs and you're not going to get a top 100 prospect for Chad Green, there is a 20 to 80 future value scale where, you know, 80 means the guy's going to be an absolute superstar, no questions asked. You know, a 60 is a guy who's probably going to be a star level player. And, you know, prospects don't generally get ranked, you know, at the high end of the 2080 scale because it's just too risky. But anyway, if you look at that scale, you know, 50 is a guy who could become a league average player. 45 is, you know, a pretty reasonable org depth guy. 40 plus is a guy who, you know, maybe doesn't make the majors. If he does, he's fringy, but there's still a little bit of upside there to tap into. So to give you some context, the Jays heading into this season had 14 prospects who are rated 40 plus or better. Now that's not great. That's not a super deep farm system at the higher end. But if we're looking for what Chad Green could return, what I would say is probably a 40 plus type prospect. So someone who would slot in the 15 to 20 range. If you're looking at the Blue Jays system after the trade, the Yankees. So, you know, if we look at what the Yankees had coming into this year, they had, you know, what, six guys in that kind of 40 plus range per Fangraphs, you know, in that. So could you get the Yankees 15th best prospect for Chad Green and he slots in and he's about your 15th best prospect? Maybe something like that. You know, it'll depend a little bit too on the money involved in that. The Yankees don't care as much about the money, but Chad Green's still making $10.5 million next season. If you paid down a little bit of that, you know, maybe you get someone a little higher on that range of guys than lower. But I think, yeah, with a reliever like Chad Green that has a year left, that has some, he has great numbers this year, but some of the underlying numbers are not that fantastic. And you would get kind of a redo on the $10.5 million for next year. If you could get a guy in that 15 to 20 in a farm system range, that's probably where you level set that one. Jimmy Garcia, you're probably aiming a little higher. Trevor Richards, you're probably aiming in that same, maybe even a little lower. Although you can also do the quality over or quantity over quality thing and send out a couple of guys as well. So sorry, I can't tell you exactly who would be coming back, but I think that's kind of what you're looking at for a reliever like Chad Green, is someone in that 40 plus future value range. So someone maybe, you know, 15th to 20th, maybe low 20s from an org ranking perspective. Let's see what Ben Clemens has to say about it. He of Fangraphs joins us now. He has been a busy man. The trade value series has started rolling out. Ben, how you feeling about it?
You know, pretty good. Every year I spend 3 weeks making sure it's all perfect. And then the night before I'm like, I bet you there's three guys who are wrong. And I mean, if there's only three guys who are wrong, I'll be happy. But it's a classic thing to be a perfectionist about.
Yeah, I feel like you would tinker a lot, like within your tiers at least. Like, is that fair? Like, you have guys tiered initially, and the tiers are a little more stable than the rankings within the tiers?
Yeah, exactly. So one thing that any list of values, this always happens, is there really are tiers, right? Like, you get 9 players down, let's say, and they're all pretty good. And then the 10th guy is a lot worse. And so you really stress over who to put 9th, right? Because they're going to look close to the 10th guy. But they're actually probably closer to 5 than 10. So this year, with some consulting with people I talked to, I was just like, I can't tell the difference between, like, say, 50 and 45. I mean, honestly, I can't tell the difference between 60 and 40, if I'm telling the truth here. But I can't tell the difference between 26 and 35. So why don't I just put some lines around them and say, hey, these people are all basically the same. I don't really know what's very different about them.
That's a fair way to do it, I think. And I think you said, yeah, 38 through 60 or something like that. We're not separated by all that much.
Yeah,
poor
exactly.
Tanner Houck, last man out there. Okay, so you also said in the write-up of this that you casted a wider net than usual. Talked to more different types of people and different parts of different organizations. What went into that? How did that, you know, kind of just shift your perspective on things by trying to cast that wider net?
Yeah, I think the main thing that added was, I feel like I've normally just talked to people who are kind of at extremes of the spectrum, either the most, like, I mean, to use the very overly broad terms, the most scouty or the most statsy. Like, I talked to somebody who was like a decision maker who's also a scout. And then I talked to somebody who is like a really good, like, quantitative kind of model driven person. And I'd kind of triangulate between those. And I realized I'd kind of prefer to have people like throughout the spectrum more rather than just one or the other. Because I think that by the end of these calls, I can often predict, you know, the guy who's extremely model driven is going to be like, why are there these large contracts on there? And this the guy who's much more of a, like, watch the players on the field and pick guy is going to be like, Bryce Harper, he's awesome. Like, move him up.
Is that the biggest change this year? Like, you did mix back in, it seemed to me at least, in what's rolled out, those guys who are already getting paid the full freight have worked their way back into the mix a little bit more?
Yeah. So that was, that should have been in last year's, if I'm being completely honest with you. I built kind of a new framework for myself. One problem I had with ranking the big contracts guys is there's some quantitative rigor to this. There's not a lot. Like I spend a lot of time, you know, going away from the pure quantitative and trying to match what's actually happening on the field kind of deal. But it is really hard to compare like a Francisco Lindor or a Bryce Harper to, you know, a pitcher making minimum salaries who's going to make arb for a few years. And last year, I felt like I had found a way to do that. And then I just wimped out and made all those guys honorable mentions because I was like, this is it's a lot of discussions and like that I'd have to have with the people who I was asking to rank this to explain it. This year, I got started earlier. I said, here's the deal. Like, here's why these guys are on here. And I think people, like, I think they made sense. I definitely had some people I talked to say, I don't think these guys should be in the top 50. I had some say, I think they should be higher up. And that, to me, means that I did it pretty well.
Yeah, I think that's how I always do it, covering the Jays or covering the Raptors. If half the audience is saying you're being too negative and half the audience is saying you're carrying water, you're probably right in the sweet spot there, somewhere in the middle. Okay, let's get into some of this stuff. Let's start with the Jays stuff. I teed it up before you came on here. I went into the kind of history of Bo and Vlad. Let's start with Alejandro Kirk, though. You had him at 39 last year, again, in that tier where he could have easily been on the list or just off the list. But he is not on the list at all and not even honorable mention this year, despite still having 3.5 years of control. That come down to basically just the bat hasn't, you know, we all love the, we all like the approach and the bat to ball and stuff like that, but he's just not hitting enough.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically it. I also, like, the Blue Jays aren't going to trade him right now. It's kind of the weird, it's the wrong time, right? Like,
yeah.
There was a better time to trade him, like, probably every year before now. And so I don't think they will trade him. I still like Kirk. Like, if I was doing a vibes and feels and what do I think is going to happen, not, or like, what do I want to happen? He would be in my top 50. I don't know. Like, I've consistently thought that he's going to figure it out because, like you said, I love the approach. I really like the kind of all fields ability. And I always thought he was better defensively than advertised. That's been true. Like, like that part of the equation was right. Honestly, he's still a useful player despite just not being able to hit when he can take the field because he's a good defender. And it's funny because, you know, he is one of the players who I spent the most time talking to people about over the 3 years I've done this list on my own because he's very divisive. Like, he doesn't look like he should be able to hit that well, basically. And I spent a long time talking to people about like what that meant. And every time I have these discussions, I come away convinced he's just going to rake. It's very, very surprising and disappointing to me that he hasn't hit better. I mean, that happens, right? Like, there's a lot of players in baseball and it happens over a lot of years. Some guys just don't develop the way you expect and want. But yeah, I mean, he's just not hitting enough to be on there. The fact that he was on there last year is largely because I really like him.
Like, yeah, you're allowed, man. You put a lot of work into this. You can, the difference between 39 and 45 can just be, you know, I really like this guy. I like a 5 foot seven catcher. Okay, the bigger name ones are obviously Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Bo Bichette, you and I have talked about a couple times this year how tough it is to peg his value when he's having such a down year, and everyone has kind of assumed all along it's Bo Bichette. He'll figure it out. He's had a bad month before, and then he's the best hitter in baseball. You know, he's never hit below 290 or OPS below 800. Well, now not only is this extended into late July here, he's fallen off your trade value list to the honorable mention category. Now he's hurt. He's going to miss at least a couple weeks here with a calf strain, so the conversation is moot anyway. But what was the process like trying to gauge Bo Bichette's value, particularly at a time where, you know, we haven't reported this here at Sportsnet, but a lot of other people in the baseball world have, like, been circling around Bo Bichette to see if he was available, at least, you know, checking in with national reporters about his availability and things like that. What was the process like trying to gauge Bichette's value?
Yeah, I'd say the thing that really came up a lot in that is there's a balancing act where if you're going to value the expensive players who are going to be around for a while, it's hard to square that with valuing guys who won't be around for a while, but who aren't super cheap. Like, it's kind of a choose two of three between, like, or choose three of four, maybe between talent, team control, affordability. Yeah, maybe choose two or three between those. And it, like, I kept being able to mostly square it. And if Bichette were having, like, last season, a good example that I could give you a counterfactual with is Kyle Tucker. If Kyle Tucker hadn't just been mysteriously out for a month and a half and still not on a track to playing, I think I would have tucked him in at the very back of the list. Okay. In fact, when we were making this, we had a bunch of contingencies in case he suddenly was healthy again. Like, oh, we'll need to change, like, these names and move these down and redo the graphics this way. And coming into this year, that's kind of where I would have placed Bichette. We've had a lot of kind of 1.5 years to free agency guys on the list before. And look, those players have a lot of value when they're going to be one of your best players in the playoff race this year. So only to playoff teams, but one of your best players in the playoff race this year, and then on your team in their walk year, and you're going to get a draft pick out of it. So teams really like that guy, but they need to fulfill the first part, best player on your team this year in the playoff race, or, you know, like, fine, you have one superstar, second best player. And I think I just have lost confidence in the 2024 part of that. Like, I still think Bichette's going to be great. And my guess is that he's just back to his normal self next year, give or take, you know, a rounding error, and signed the big free agency deal. But when this year's playoff chase is a big chunk of what you're getting, I think I just couldn't get comfortable kind of squeezing him into the back end of this list. And I mean, that sounds right when you actually stop and look at kind of who the players are here. So, like, the Pirates are in a playoff race and they don't need a shortstop. But if they did, I still think they wouldn't trade Jared Jones for Bo Bichette.
Right.
It just hurts too much. Now, if Bichette was, like, an MVP candidate, I think that really changes things around. You can start looking at your guy and saying, well, I don't know, like, he needs 5 days of rest every time. Like, he's on the IL, he has shoulder issues, he has command issues. But you don't want to have to, like, first poke holes in your guy and then figure out the way their guy's going to get better. I think it's kind of a one of two. And so I bet you, you could trade Bichette even now for a bunch of like pretty good prospects. But I don't see any reason why not. But I think that getting a guy who is like already doing it at the major league level and has a lot of future value is just a little bit much of a lift when he's not on right now. And that's what kept him off the list. If he was playing like last year, he'd be on there basically.
Right. Which makes sense. And that's why he was higher than Vladimir Guerrero Jr. last year, which is, you know, it's interesting to see them kind of trade spots with each other over the years. Vlad also not on the list this year. He drops the honorable mention. A similar thing with him in terms of, hey, he's a year closer to free agency. He also doesn't have the benefit of having that cheap cost control that Bo Bichette does. Vlad's a super two guy who's going to make over $20 million in arbitration next year. So there's a little extra cost to that. And he is having the second best season of his career, probably, when we look at the numbers. He's not going to touch 2021 again. And I guess probably that's the takeaway here, is that if he's not going to touch that 2021 level again as a first baseman slash DH with a year and a half of control, it's just it would be tough for anyone at that position to have, you know, top 30 trade value still, right?
Yeah. I mean, he needs to, like, you could if you were like Juan Soto. I think that would do it. Like, I had Soto on there last year with similar defensive value to Vlad. I think Vlad is a better first baseman than the metrics let on. And I think the first base penalty is a little steep, and Soto's not a great outfielder, but he's just a better hitter. I think that Vlad would fetch a lot at the trade deadline still. In talking to several different teams, they noted that, you know, hey, like, these honorable mentions make sense to me and these don't. And no one was like, oh, I don't think Vlad should be mentioned. They were all like, yeah, I mean, he's going to be a really interesting case to see what he gets at the deadline, because I think you can talk yourself into him being one of the best hitters on your good team as a playoff team this year. And again, like, that's going to be a discussion that tilts people's decisions internally a lot on these. Is, can I see this person like really adding to our playoff race this year? The math of like how many years of control remaining, how many wins under control, the price for those wins. Look, teams are really good at doing that, but you start getting the like, what is my playoff equity into this? And then that's when they start rounding up and like, oh, like, we wanted to give our 15th best prospect, they want our 8th. We could probably do that. It's when you, because the playoffs are, they're like, it really matters how you're playing right into them. And it matters for more than the whole regular season almost, right? Like, I think that makes it easier for people to round up. And I think Vlad is going to get the benefit of that this year.
Yeah, that's a good way to frame it. I guess what becomes clear in having a similar discussion about Bo and Vlad there is, I don't know, when you look at where the Blue Jays are at in general, not to be like, having two guys on the honorable mention who you still have a year of control over after this season and they're still young is like a positive, and Kirk's not a negative asset now and things like that. But when if we track kind of Bo and Vlad over the last couple of years, where they're, hey, they're both in the top 20, Vlad's even number two, and then they're staying around the top 20. Okay, Vlad's 30, but they're both still on here, and now they're both honorable mention. You know, does it highlight for you how this window for the Jays, while not closed, because you could extend Vlad and you could extend Bo, but the whole idea with having two young potential star position players is that you can spend while they're inexpensive, and that's how you build a team around them. And now that they're going to be the expensive pieces, you know, the first wave of that window really is about to close for the Blue Jays.
Yeah. I think that's well said. And honestly, like, the intent was clearly there. You look at the way the roster is built now with Springer, you know, with Gausman, like with Robbie Ray before that, they, Berríos, they weren't unwilling to follow this blueprint. I think you and I and they would all agree on what the blueprint was. And like you said, like, you should do this when they're cost controlled, when they're cheaper than they will be later. They did. Yeah, it didn't work out well. This is something I think about a lot. Like, the process was pretty good. You look at the roster and you're like, yeah, that's what I mean, I don't know if I would have signed George Springer specifically. I can't remember what I thought about him heading into free agency. I'm not saying I wouldn't. I don't know. I didn't deep dive as much as teams do. But I like their overall intent with what they did. And you have to say that if you look at the like level of team talent, level of underlying like runs scored and allowed, you'd be content with what the Jays did. They've just stacked it up in like in these ways where they're losing in the first round or just missing the playoffs. Yeah, it's one of those like real what could have been rosters. I'm with you that I don't think it's over. Like, I honestly think that ranking these guys on the trade value list and putting them in honorable mentions, like maybe they're gonna blow it all up and trade them both. I don't really think so. Like, it doesn't feel like the era's over. It feels like there's a better team in there somewhere. And like doing it when Bichette's having a down year and when a lot of the kind of peripheral pieces aren't clicking, I kind of don't see it ending that way. Maybe I'm too romantic. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. And there are like non-baseball factors too of like you got seats to fill and you know, you've got a general manager and to a lesser extent a president who are probably navigating this trade deadline for their jobs and things like that. And how does that look if you trade away, you know, Bo and Vlad? And then it'll be a conversation again in the offseason. But everything we've heard here is that, you know, they're going to sell the guys who are free agents at the end of this year. We've started to hear a little bit more. Maybe they'd listen on some of the, you know, like I think you could get Chad Green. If Yankees Twitter wants him that bad, here you go. You could have Chad Green, guys like that, maybe even an Isaiah Conner Falefa. But yeah, but I mean, Bo's hurt now anyway, so it's probably moot. But yes. Hard to see that or Vlad happening this year. Before we continue on with the trade value series, I did want to touch on you did a rundown of the relievers on the trade block. You mentioned a couple Blue Jays within that piece. Because you're very good at this thing, I wanted to level set for the listeners. When we talk about, and you had mentioned Chad Green, Trevor Richards, and Nate Pearson as potentially interesting names out of the Blue Jays bullpen. Jimmy Garcia's back now since you wrote that and looked really good. So he probably goes top of that list. I would wonder if Yenesis Cabrera, whose ERA is dipped below four now, and he's had a really good month. Maybe he has some interest as well. But, you know, what are we looking at? Let's start with the Jimmy Garcia type, who's one of the better relievers available and is now back and looks healthy. You know, are we talking a 45 future value prospect back for that? Is that too high a bar for a relief rental?
I don't think so. I think that this year's relief pitcher landscape is pretty barren. It depends if Mason Miller is available, but everything I've heard is that the A's are basically asking for a lot, and I think they should. I think that's pretty reasonable. And that makes it, at best, 50-50 to me that he gets traded. After that, it's thin. And if you don't like Tanner Scott, like, yeah, you should be calling about Jimmy Garcia. That's it. That's it for the guys who I would feel really good, or like pretty good, as one of the back two in my bullpen. Chad Green is honestly not that far behind that list. I think a 45 future value style of prospect is about in the right ballpark. You kind of reverse the Jordan Hicks trade from last year is a way to think about it. And honestly, like, I liked that trade for both sides at the time, because there are teams do have these like extra prospects who like might make an impact but won't necessarily make an impact lying around. And when you need a reliever, when you're right in the race, like that matters more. Like getting it now matters more. So I think this will kind of be a recoup the Jays on that trade from last year, and everybody can be happy with that. And if you think about it this way, if there's net no prospect cost, then the Jays got an extra reliever in the year where they needed it, and they didn't have a reliever in the year where they didn't need it, because look, they're not making the playoffs this year, so who really cares if you have Yimi Garcia for the last 2 months? It worked out pretty well. They essentially rented, they borrowed into 2023 a reliever when they wanted one. That feels about right to me. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see that. And I think in the extreme case where something bad happens to Scott in the next week, you know, just like an injury, huge blow up, I don't know, the Marlins are the Marlins and decide not to trade him, I think you could see even a little more than that, because it's just a scarcity thing. Like I was looking for names that are interesting, and it's like, oh man, like if the Reds really blow it up and decide to trade Fernando Cruz, maybe, but they just don't, that's just not how they operate.
No, and they're, I mean, I know the Fangraphs odds don't love their chances, but games behind-wise, they're not far out, and you probably don't want to do that to a clubhouse and a young team and your fan base and things like that. With respect to that Green, Richards, Pearson, Cabrera tier, Green obviously has the factor of he's owed $10.5 million for next year. The rest of those guys are cheap/expiring. Are you getting kind of just the guy type prospect at that point?
I think Green will get a little more. Okay. I don't think teams are too disappointed that he's owed $10.5 million because it means he'll still be around.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you're really going out into free agency next year and getting spending less than $10.5 million and getting Chad Green for a year. Like, he's pretty good. He's healthy again. The reason he's on this deal is because he needed to prove his injury was fixed. You know, he signed it when he was hurt. So I think that does limit the market, the teams who think who are confident they'll be contending next year too. So like maybe the Pirates aren't betting on Chad Green because they're both cost constrained and a little less stable in like what they're going to do next year. They're still so young. Yeah, I think the rest, I just don't think the Jays can trade Pearson. I think it's not just that it plays bad in the fan base. I bet you it would play bad in the front office. How many people in that front office love Nate Pearson like for years and years? And then you're going to trade him for essentially like, I mean, because he hasn't been that good, like a lottery ticket. I just don't see it. Yeah, Cabrera is definitely a like, hey, I would take a flyer for Yenesis Cabrera. That's all it cost them. So again, this is a classic, like, you know, it's a closed system. There's no cost in the end. And they got Yenesis Cabrera for a pretty good, like he was pretty good last year in the playoff chase. I was surprised.
Yeah, and he's been pretty good this year. It's an adventure sometimes, but the stuff is pretty good. All right, let's move outside of the Blue Jays. Let's look at the rest of this trade value series. And I know only through number 31 are up right now, which means I can officially ask you the question now of why do you hate Jackson Holliday, who is at number 37 and behind his own teammate in Jordan Westberg?
So I have a very good reason for this. And I think I convinced almost everyone I was talking to. No one I'm talking to is like the person pulling the trigger on trades, just to be clear.
Right.
Like they're the advisors. I don't have all the GMs on speed dial. I wish that'd be cool. But look, Jackson Holliday is a really great value of a player. He's going to be around for a long time. He projects really well. He's back to destroying AAA. People definitely had some questions about his, you know, long-term ceiling because he has a weird line. If you look at it, he walks 25% of the time and strikes out 25% of the time and doesn't actually have that much power. And it's like, huh, I can't really picture that.
Two true outcomes.
But yeah, he's really, really two true outcomes. Like I haven't seen anyone quite like this in a little bit. Basically, the argument that I made to everyone is, you know, the kind of person in your fantasy league or in really anything who needs to win everything. And like the Rays, let's call it. The Rays are the guy in like whatever walk of life you pursue that'll do anything if they get a small edge, one red paperclip style. And that's one type of trader that sets values for things. And then there's the like, I want to win this year. Let's do that. And those guys often drive the trade market because like they have a thing that they're trying to reach. They and the person they're trading with have disparate goals. And that makes a trade. Like you kind of need to have, if you both have the same goals and valuations and needs, well, nothing's going to get done, right? Like you're just like, well, I'll trade you this apple for that apple. Okay, fine. But other than that, nothing gets done. Holliday, unfortunately, as a trade asset that you're giving up a ton for, feeds into the problem of same goals, same valuations. The people who want to trade for Jackson Holliday are the ones who win every trade. Because they're like, this guy is worth a lot. And like, I could get him for less than that. And then I'll be better in the long run. But there's not a lot of people like Dave Dombrowski's and their ilk who are like, I need to go get Jackson Holliday this year to win. The Orioles aren't playing him. like the Orioles want to win so badly. They went and traded for Corbin Burns. Like they got the most rental pitcher there is. And they're not playing Jackson Holliday. So how in the world is he going to drive like a high end, like do something a little stupid valuation? It's just the offers you'd get for him are people trying to like buy the dip, like trying to spend 90 cents for a dollar. And that just gets rid of the top end of the market. And that's really what sets your value, I think.
Okay. Well, elsewhere in Baltimore, I'd imagine some of their other guys might be very, very high on this list. Yes. When the final part comes out on Friday, you don't have to give it away. But I am curious as to the process between, say, a Gunnar Henderson and a Bobby Witt, where they are both young, unbelievably good shortstops. One of them is locked in super long term on a deal that pays him a little bit more money. There is more money on the table versus, you know, in Bobby Witt, obviously he has that, 12 or 13 year deal versus Gunnar Henderson, who is incredibly cheap, no long-term contract. Like that difference between, like, I would assume why, as you were doing this, you evaluated them as like very, very similar in terms of talent and age and things like that position. And then who gets the spot over the other one might come down to, would you rather have the 6 years super cheap or the 12 years that gets more expensive, but you have 12 years? How did you work that out if those guys are as close as I imagine they're going to be?
Yeah, so this is a Blake Murphy exclusive spoiler. They're going to be 1-2 in some order.
Okay.
I'm not going to give away the order, but I will tell you what one team analyst who I really like and I'd say was the closest to my valuations said. He was like, here's my own ranking of the top five. I'm not going to give you any of the names specifically, except for he said 1-2, Henderson, Witt, flip a coin. And I was like, oh man, like you're getting really close to how it feels to do this process. You put it really well. Deciding between those two just really comes down to like how long do you want to pay someone who's incredible? And would you rather, I mean, I think it's a great question in life. Like, would you rather get a 10% discount for 12 years or a 30% discount for five? And I don't think there's one right answer to that. I think it's very dependent on context. I'm like dispositionally a 10% discount for 12 years guy. There's a reason that Fernando Tatis Jr. is always really high on this list. And I talk to a lot of people and they're like, I don't know. He's definitely one of my like flag planting guys. But look, the Gunnar Henderson is really good. It's one thing when you say, oh, I'll take this like slightly smaller discount because it's so hard to get a player this good otherwise. Gunnar Henderson is that good. And I think this is the toughest decision I've had about the top of the list in a good way in a long time. There's a lot of years where I'm like, these top four guys all have obvious red flags and I will just pick one whose red flag I dislike the least. Or it's like none of these guys are exciting, but they all have great deals. Like Ozzie Albies at the top of the trade list. Ugh. Like those years are no fun when it's about the money. It's not about the money with Witt and Henderson. It's a tiebreaker, but they're both incredible. Like you could have them on a 10-year, $300 million deal starting right now, and teams would be lining up to trade for them. And that's great because that makes the job a lot more fun when you're like, you know, is it the A or the A plus than like picking for nits. So very happy to be making this decision.
So,
and yeah.
So the two shortstops then are 1-2. You've given us that. Paul Skeens is pretty good too. He is, you know, he started the All-Star game 1 year after being drafted, obviously loads of control and no questions that he's going to be very, very good. When it comes to, hey, couple handful of really exciting prospects, just lean toward the position player given the stability and the less injury risk associated with that type of player?
Yeah. Here's another little inside the process nugget for you. I did not have Skeens as high as he finished on the list. You've seen the final
list. Yeah, I'm trying not to give it away, but
he's fairly high. I'm not going to say where. I had him lower, and then everyone I talked to was like, I'd have Skeens higher. I'd have Skeens higher. I'd have Skeens higher. It was just like, at some point I was like, I am not evaluating this right. Like all these people who I think very differently and whose decision-making I can mostly predict are all telling me I'm wrong. Like just, and not wrong in different ways, like all wrong in the same way. Like you're just not thinking about this correctly. And I like redid it and I asked them why I was wrong and thought about it more. And yeah, I think that there's a real push to not value pitchers too highly. And the top four pitchers on my list last year all blew out their elbows in the next like 5 months. It was just like an absolute disaster. But that the best four pitchers in baseball blew out their elbows. Like it's really hard to have good pitching. Paul Skeens is very valuable. There's no one like him. It's a weird puzzle because I don't know, like he wasn't supposed to be this good. I don't think anyone's supposed to be this good. But you kind of have to believe what your eyes are telling you at some point. And that, I think, is a lesson that I really got from this year's iteration is this guy is doing it. And he's doing it in a way that like computers look at and are like, yep, that looks real. And that, like, have you watched him pitch? Like, I watch him pitch. Yeah. I'm just like, this guy's the best pitcher ever. Like, he's throwing a 97 mile an hour splitter.
I watched him do a triple. I saw him do a triple A start earlier this year, and it was a joke. Yeah. Like he was laughing with his catcher on the mound with some of his pitches. It was the first time all year. It was the first time since he had gone pro that he had allowed consecutive hits in that game against the Jays triple A team. Like, ridiculous. Okay, so there's obviously a big risk if you're a pitcher, you blow your elbow out. What if you're a pitcher, you blew your elbow out, and while you're rehabbing, you hit 30 home runs, had an OPS over 1,000, stole a bunch of bases as well. Man, Shohei signed a $700 million contract, which has to disrupt the way you traditionally do these, where the guys who have already gotten paid the money are harder to rank. What'd you do with Shohei? There's the pitching future thing, the injury thing, the $700 million thing. I guess I don't even know for sure if he's on the list. I assume he's on there somewhere in the top 30. What'd you do with the Ohtani component?
I got some incredible answers on this. I calibrated my list in advance thinking, here are some things that I feel fairly confident about. Gunnar Henderson and Bobby Witt are among the top trade values in all of baseball. And if I built this system in a way that doesn't shove them to the very top, it's wrong. I said someone like Juan Soto or Kyle Tucker should, and, you know, Bichette before the year should be around 50th, between 50th and 60th. Someone like Aaron Judge should fit on the list somewhere because it's very hard to replace that production. And teams all want to trade for Ohtani. I feel very confident in all that. And I think that actually, when you break things down between how much talent is available to you as a team, like that you're guaranteed to get, and the cost, I think Ohtani is very justifiably in the top 25. I think the real difficulty with him comes down to the fact that trying to classify his value as mostly on field is strange. Like, the Dodgers make just an ungodly amount of money because he's Shohei Ohtani. The Angels made an ungodly amount of money because he's Shohei Ohtani. The Angels have a crazy amount of Japanese fans now. Angels games are still plastered in Japanese language advertisements. Like, they've kept the fans because people like the other players because they watched every game to see Ohtani. I know for a fact that the Giants offered Ohtani the same deal. Ohtani told teams what to offer him, and they did. Like, this was not a, like, let's just bid until we get to the top. He was like, here's the contract you're signing me to. And teams were like, great, let's do it. And then he only picked one. Like, if the Giants, to pick a team who, I mean, the Jays are a slightly more confusing situation, I guess, because I don't, like, Ohtani has a no trade clause and might not want to move across country. And maybe he's never been on that flight at all. Like, I forget the exact specifics of it, but, you know, maybe.
I mean, he's been here to play. So he has been on a flight here from LA before. That much we can confirm at this point. He hit a home run the second he got booed.
That's fair. I think that teams, if the Dodgers were like, something terribly strange has happened in Dodgers ownership and we have to tear the team down, Shohei blesses a trade, like, teams would be lining up. And I am sure the money would have people in the front office tearing their hair out. And I'm sure the owner would just be like, are you kidding me? That's Shohei Ohtani. Like, what are you doing? Like, go get Shohei Ohtani. I've seen him. He's the best player in baseball. Let's go get him. When I talked to people on the team side, a lot of them just laughed. One of them said, you might as well put him first. Like, he's the best player in baseball. Like, he'll never be available in trade. And it would just be very strange if so. The thing is, I've had those discussions about Ohtani each the last 3 years, because, like, when he was a rental, someone was like, you should probably make him the best trade value in baseball. I was like, really? And it was just like, well, what if it gives you a 5% edge in signing him? Very hard to, when there's a clear best player, I mean, this is like minus the player maximum salary. This is like, you know, LeBron in the NBA in terms of their, at his peak, in terms of it being a very clear best. Baseball, the best player matters less, and there's no player maximum. And so the crazy extreme trade values, like, disparities you get are muted. But look, he's the best player in baseball. He is not too old. he is, like, when he decided to focus on hitting for a year because he's rehabbing, he's like, what, the second best hitter in baseball behind Aaron Judge. And it looks like he might just keep improving. He's insane, insanely good. Like, I didn't talk to anyone who was like, no, I think that this is bad on the numbers. I talked to people who just laughed, and they're like, I don't even know what you do with this.
Oh, man. Well, it's fun. I can't wait to see where he ranks. Can't wait to read the top 30 as they roll out Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at Fangraphs. Ben Clemens, thanks for taking the time, man. Keep up all that great work. Happy you got to the finish line with it.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on again, Blake.
Ben Clemens of Fangraphs. Again, go make sure you go check that out. The introductory and honorable mention parts out, and then 50 through 31 are out. You get all the Jays info you need in that introduction and honorable mention. No Jays making the top 50 there, I don't think, but it's a tremendously valuable series and just really fun exercise to read through it and hear what front office executives have been saying about all these players. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to give you some Jays tickets for the weekend. We're going to set you up for game one of this Jays Rays series as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ben Ennis.
And I'm Brent Gunning.
We got you covered on all things Leafs, Raptors, and Blue Jays every weekday morning, 6 to 9.
It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Let's give you some Blue Jays tickets. Maybe you want to say goodbye to Yusei Kikuchi on Friday, just in case it's his last start here. The Blue Jays Caribbean Carnival returns to Rogers Center on Friday, July 26th, with live music, dance performances, and plenty of activations around the ballpark to help kick this off. We'll be giving away a pair of tickets to Friday's game against the Rangers. To enter for a chance to win, text today's code word, Carnival, to 590-590. Standard message and data rates may apply. Again, today's code word is Carnival. Text us into 590-590 right now to enter for your chance to win tickets to the game on Friday, July 26th. We have one last pair of tickets to give away tomorrow, so be sure to tune in. If you're going down to the ballpark tonight, you will see Jose Berríos against Sean Armstrong. Neil Salon's telling us earlier that it's possible Tyler Alexander gets called up to be kind of the bulk man behind Armstrong. Tyler Alexander, of course, earlier this season threatened to no-hit the Blue Jays until they finally got to him. And I think the seventh inning in that one, that was kind of the peak of, oh, no, this Jays team can't hit still again, et cetera. The Rays come in 50 and 50. They're 5.5 back in the wild card. A lot of reports have suggested they're going to be buyers and sellers, which is kind of what the Rays do even when they're fully in it. Always looking at the long-term value, the surplus value, things like that. They are, you know, potentially getting Jeffrey Springs and Drew Rasmussen back at some point. Ryan Pepiot just hit the IL, though. Shane McClanahan's obviously on the IL. Yandy Diaz is on the restricted list, and we don't have a firm timeline for him. So it's a Rays team in flux. It's part of why they're starting Sean Armstrong today. He's an opener. 3-2. The Rays have gone 3-2 when he opens games. He hasn't gone past two innings, so you're looking at him as basically an opener only. He is below average across the board. He has a slightly above average chase percentage, but we're talking fourth percentile when it comes to expected ERA based on swing and miss and the quality of contact and things like that. He basically just throws three fastballs. There's a four-seamer, a sinker, and a cutter. He'll throw those all to righties and lefties. They sit 90 to 94 from the cutter at 90 to the four-seamer at 94. He does have a slider, but he doesn't throw it a ton anyway. The Jays have seen him for 43 plate appearances collectively, 459 batting average and 541 slugging, including Vladimir Guerrero Jr. being 8-for-11 with three walks. George Springer also 4-for-9 with three walks. So they've had some good success against Sean Armstrong in the past. On the other side, Jose Berríos, mirrored in the worst six start stretch he's had since 2022. Over those six starts, only 33 innings, a 6.82 ERA, eight homers, seven hit batters, 11 walks, and 35 hits, all to just 23 strikeouts, and opponents with an 8.25 OPS against him. He leads Major League Baseball in home runs allowed with 21. The Blue Jays as a staff lead Major League Baseball in home runs allowed. The Rays are second, but the Rays, like the Blue Jays, don't hit a lot of home runs. So who knows how this one is going to shake out. Brios saw Tampa Bay in the season opener, gave up 2 over 6 innings. They have faced him for 85 plate appearances overall, and those active Rays against Brios are hitting 181 with a 277 slugging percentage and a 29% strikeout rate. So Brios with a pretty good track record against this group of Tampa Bay Rays, but it is a Rays team that has only lost one of their last 9 series and is playing to maintain their playoff life here, get back above 500, get back into that wild card race. So, a Rays team that's pretty motivated against a Jays team that front office and trade market wise wouldn't mind seeing the Rays win a few games. The guys on the field want to win those games. Of course, Jose Brios wants to win that game, but it wouldn't be the worst thing for the trade deadline if the Jays didn't play all that well against the Rays and the Rangers. We'll be back at 10 o'clock tomorrow to help you break this one down and set up tomorrow's game. We'll also do some more trade stuff, of course. Thank you to Caitlin McGrath, to Neil Solans, to Ben Clemens for joining us. Thanks to Austin Mackey, Amon Mon, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Talk to you tomorrow.